Good morning, and welcome to another year of medical ethics / medical halacha shiurim. This particular one, logotherapy in Judaism, is dedicated for Shmuel David ben Yeshua Heschel HaKohen, whose yard site is today. Please make sure that you sign in. I want to be able to. Well, first of all, if you need credit, then you need to sign in. But aside from that, I want to be able to follow up afterwards on questions that come up during the session. This is a topic that I addressed once before at Shari Shamayim, and there were many questions and much food for thought, and I was able to follow up with people afterwards. I like to be able to do it, so please make sure to sign in. I apologize for it being a makeshift sign-in sheet, but I'm out of practice as well, since it's the start of the year. We haven't done this in a few months, and I forgot to bring the sign-in sheet, so they're makeshift, but they still work. The same three columns, the name, email, address, and then if you want to sign up to receive information about further programs, then check the box in the last column as well. The next session, God willing, will be at Shari Shamayim, and that will be Monday evening, November 27th. And the topic is informing patients of a terminal diagnosis. So that's Monday evening, the 27th. If I could ask people to put their cell phones on vibrate or silent or something along those lines, that would be helpful. Thank you. So I want to make three introductory notes to the topic. First of all, I want to begin by acknowledging the importance of Rabbi Reuven Bulka's papers on logotherapy and religion. I learned a great deal from his work on this, much of which is available online. Not to mention, I was able to cut and paste various quotes, thanks to him, for the source sheet for books that otherwise I would have had to retype by hand. He actually had done the work already. That's number one. Number two, as I think most of you know, I am not a psychologist. I am not a therapist. I am working to the best of my understanding, but if, as we're going through this, you have an insight, particularly I know some people here are familiar with logotherapy, please, as always, chime in. And then finally, I'm also not recommending logotherapy in general or for any particular condition. That's up to the experts. I happen to think it's pretty neat, but that's a personal opinion. Okay, so I brought you the first four sources on the sheet, just to show the utility of this method of psychotherapy, and we're going to talk about what it is. That's the bulk of our time, but I just wanted to show you the range of its utility, which will also, along the way, give us a little bit of a sense of what it is. The first source is regarding helping older adolescents with depression. From the Journal of Mental Health Counseling. There are more sheets still, right? The sheets are over there in the middle. Okay, good. On a weekly basis, over a three-week period, talk about a particular case, this adolescent scored an average of 40 on the BDI, Beck Depression Inventory, indicating severe depression. Reviewing his scores on the BDI and verbalizing his various problems, he further recognized the enormous weight of his depression. Following this three-week period, after we had developed rapport, I assisted him in reframing the meaning of his depression by asking him to think about its possible meaning, and then asking, let's assume that your depression is purposeful, that it's trying to convey a message to you, telling you that some change needs to be made in your life. Your job is to figure out what that change is, and then to make it. After taking sufficient time to think, he responded that he had always wanted to read philosophy, but had never taken the time to do so. We discussed some of the titles he wanted to read, and when the book Atlas Shrugged was mentioned, he became excited and decided that was the book he would read. Who would have thought Ayn Rand would cure someone of depression? He purchased and read the book. Within a two-week period, and with no additional interventions, his score on the BDI dropped to 10, indicating a normal mood range. This is a full paper. I just brought you a brief excerpt from it. All the papers that I bring you here are available online. You can Google their titles to see more. Second one, internet addiction. Internet addiction, particularly when it is related to social networking programs such as Facebook, MySpace, Olav Shalom, or Second Life, is indicative, it was 2012, at that time it existed, is indicative of the existential concept of escaping from the self rather than reliance on self. Individuals feel the need to escape the self for different reasons. It, the self, may have become burdensome, empty, a source of embarrassment, or repulsive. Addictive behaviors are the pathological logical result of this dissatisfaction with or rejection of the self. And then as he goes on to, as the article goes on to explain, they talk about using logotherapy to help people to find themselves purposeful, their lives meaningful, and to free them of the need for this, the need in this case for the internet addiction. The third source of these introductory sources is on geriatric logotherapy, and this one I found particularly compelling. Another example of geriatric logotherapy is the case of Dr. Watson, a retired philosophy professor living alone in his home as a widower with two adult children living far away. Dr. Watson is in his late 80s, was once a nationally recognized scholar, author of several books, but these days finds reading increasingly difficult owing to glaucoma and writing virtually impossible due to arthritis in both hands. Dr. Watson had essentially, quote, given up, as he put it, because of an inability to read or write, his life's work and passion. When the therapist encouraged the professor to, quote, tell me about your life's work, Dr. Watson commenced slowly and deliberately rattling off his educational background, teaching appointments, books written, conferences attended, all with little passion and near expressionless. However, when the therapist asked about specific colleagues mentioned in the monotone narrative, he noticed that the patient became somewhat animated, enthusiastic, even excited to relate story after story involving colleagues, happy stories, fun stories, all leading to an extremely productive journey through time and people of importance. Subsequent sessions centered upon the same topics, with the result that Dr. Watson began calling old friends, inviting other retired colleagues in town to come for morning coffee and chat. The door of happy memories had been opened and entered, and Dr. Watson's life took on renewed vitality. The common denominator in these cases, and in the treatment for them, is a sense that what is missing for the person involved is an activity in which they seek meaning. They're seeking purpose. And we're going to talk more and define meaning and purpose better. But the idea that we're going to see and explore within logotherapy is the idea that this is what people need in life, that there's actually a basic need for a human being to have a sense of purpose, something that they are working towards that has this thing we call meaning, and that the absence of that can lead to neurosis, which can be dealt with by helping the person to find and to engage in this pursuit. There was a study, someone emailed me over the summer, it was just a month or two ago. There's a paper that came out in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, in their psychiatry edition in August of 2017. I gave you the link, I gave you the title on here in source number 4. In which they did studies and found that seniors who have a sense of purpose in life, you can actually predict it's prospectively associated with the maintenance of physical strength and function, measured by grip strength, measured by by their gait, the way they walk. This is something that bears out not only in terms of mental health, but in terms of physical health and the way that the body continues its function. So the questions I want to address here are two. Number one, a history question, after we define what logotherapy is, but after that, a history question. Is this rooted in Judaism? Viktor Frankl was Jewish, indeed, as we'll talk about. And then a second question, and frankly the practical one, is this consistent with Judaism, and will it be effective with Jewish patients who believe in and practice Judaism? Will it be effective? Is there a reason to believe that this would resonate more in some way with observant Jews? That's where I wanted to go with the topic over the next hour or so. Clear so far? Okay? All right. Again, for anyone who's coming in late to this, there are still some source sheets there in the middle of the table, and more important, there is a sign-in sheet, which I would ask people to take advantage of. Okay, so first we need to talk about what it is that logotherapy believes and practices. And we start with the nature of man, the nature of the human being. Viktor Frankl, who is the founder of logotherapy, wrote about this in the course of several books and papers. His most famous book, of course, is Man's Search for Meaning, which is a two-part book. Right? One part of it is about logotherapy, and the other part is about his experiences in the concentration camps. But in Man's Search for Meaning, in source number 5, he wrote something that I think is basic to our understanding of what's going on in the beliefs of logotherapy, which is that each person is unique. So in source number 5 on your sheet, tasks form man's destiny, which is different and unique for each individual. No man and no destiny can be compared with any other man or any other destiny. No situation repeats itself, and each situation calls for a different response. Every situation is different, every individual is different, and that's going to become very important as we discuss the different meanings that people find. But he starts off with his understanding of what a human being is. And he says that each human being with a unique nature and a unique environment, a unique situation, is influenced by the environment, is influenced by genetics, is influenced by all of the different elements that shape who we are, but is not bound by them. Unlike the animal, and if this sounds like free will, you're right, he's going to use the term. Unlike the animal, a human being is capable of responding to that environment and choosing what that response is going to be. So take a look at source number 6, where he writes in The Doctor and the Soul, "Certainly man is free, but he is not floating freely in airless space. He is always surrounded by a host of restrictions. These restrictions, however, are the jumping-off points for his freedom. Freedom presupposes restrictions, is contingent upon restrictions. If we wanted to define man, we would have to call him that entity which has freed itself from whatever has determined it as biological, psychological, sociological type. That entity, in other words, that transcends all these determinants, either by conquering them and shaping them, or by deliberately submitting to them." And that last point, I think, is particularly interesting. If you submit to your environment, that's a decision as well. A person who says, "This is the way I was born," right? Or a person who mimics whatever his parents taught him, is also making a decision, even if it's just, you know, by being passive, it's still a decision. And a human being is free to either respond to these influences via his own decision, via his own determination of "I want to do X," or by saying "I'm not going to do X and I'm not going to change anything." Now, how does Frankl know that a person has free will? Not because he opens up the Pasuk or the Rambam to tell him that he has free will, but rather by observation. Take a look at source number 7, please, where he lays it out for you, based on his experience in the camps. And this is Rabbi Bolka's presentation of Frankl's thought. "Freedom to Frankl demands no special proof. It belongs, quote, to the immediate data of his experience. Freud once said, try and subject a number of very strongly differentiated human beings to the same amount of starvation. With the increase of the imperative need for food, all individual differences will be blotted out, and in their place we shall see the uniform expression of the one unsatisfied instinct." So Freud's thought is that when you get to your basic needs, when you reduce a person to hunger in the case here, everybody acts the same. All the ways in which they may be differentiated, profession, personality, whatever it is, disappear when you get down to basic needs. And Frankl says, that's not my experience. The concentration camps, in Frankl's view, proved Freud wrong. The camps proved that man cannot be reduced to a function of heredity and environment, for at the same time that some inmates degenerated into the innate camp bestiality, others exhibited the virtues of saintliness. A third variable found only in the spiritual animal, man, is the decisive factor in human behavior, choice, or decision. Man ultimately decides for himself. He says, I saw people who were in the situation Freud described. I saw people who were starving. And they didn't all respond the same way. Yeah.
But he's saying that, you know, it is a function of hereditary, because you don't know what homes these people came from. You don't know what impact their parents made on them or who they were. It wasn't a controlled study.
Right.
you know, if you were going to say two people who grew up in the same home, have the same background, identical twins, essentially.
Right.
Then maybe. It's a little bit broad.
Yes, it is broad. I mean, yeah, I struggle in general as I go through psychology, and particularly in this topic, with questions that I can't put to Frankl to answer, and this is definitely one of them. We're going to see another one not too long from now. I think his response could well be, and I think it's borne out by the experiences of survivors and their testimony, that you did see people with very similar backgrounds respond in very different ways, and you could always break that down and say, well, maybe there was an X factor we're not familiar with, and that was what made the distinction, for which, frankly, even in a controlled experiment, you can't really account. Certainly with the sheer numbers of people involved and the range of their responses, I'm inclined towards what he says, but at the same time recognize there's a certain unscientific character to it. Right. I would agree with that. By the way, in general, please feel free to interject. I don't like monologuing. Those who have been here before know that. So please, no restriction on that one. Until I say I have 5 minutes left and I have to finish. At that point, then there's a restriction. Okay. But this is Frankl's belief about the nature of the human being. We have free will. He believes he observed that himself. Each human being is unique. We bring our own experiences and backgrounds and environments to the table, but it's up to us to exercise our free will, which will determine the way we will respond to all of those influences. That's his basic belief about the nature of the human being. Yeah?
Sorry, I'm just processing. I think he said something, though, along the lines that most people reacted much like Freud predicted, but there were a few who didn't, and he said, although the few proved that Freud was wrong, because those few clearly made a choice to act differently. So in terms of nature versus nurture, I think that almost strengthens the choice perspective.
Right.
I don't know if that makes
sense. I think I hear what you're saying. I mean, he would view both nature and nurture as fundamentally environmental factors.
Right.
You know, it's not as though, you know, they're different, but they're both under that same rubric of what isn't my free will.
Right.
But I also think that it is true. He'll acknowledge that the majority did have a uniform response.
Right.
And that's where Freud gets his idea from. The fact that the majority do. But it doesn't mean that it's universal. It doesn't mean
that
the option is
lost. The few did not act that way. To him,
right.
Prove that, in fact,
right.
You can choose.
I hear that. Thank you. So let's move from the nature of human beings to the problem that people experience, which logotherapy is fundamentally meant to address. In Frankl's thought, and I said this in the introduction, human beings have a need to find meaning, and better put, probably, to search for meaning. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 8, this is again by Bulka's observation. To conceive of man as one who wills, right, someone who wants, as one who is pulled by meaning, is to conceive of a world filled with objective meaning. Now, the word objective is something we're going to have to come back to. That requires definition. But right now, just pretend you didn't see it. A world filled with meaning. Frankl stands in rigid opposition to the homunculus. Nothing but picture of man. Man portrayed as biology, sociology, psychology. The subject, man, being reduced to object. As well as the subjectivization of all values, the reduction of meaning to mere self-expression. Let me unpack that a little bit. He says, if you think of a human being as just bag of bones, so to speak, that we are our biology, we are our influences, and our reactions are all just the sort of knee-jerk response based on our background, based on our genes, or whatever it is, and therefore, meaning is all about me. And that's what he means by the subjectivization of all values. Meaning to me will be based on whatever it is that I have lived and desired, which is all based on my genes, which is all based on my background, which is based on how I was raised, which is based on my needs. And everything is just about that. And there is no opportunity to transcend that. the he says that that's the opposite of Frankl. He says the idea is that we are being pulled to look for something that is beyond ourselves. And he uses what is to me a beautiful image. Man, like the decrepit ark, needs a pulling tension, right? If you think of something in orbit, and it's starting to descend from orbit, and it needs something else, some other pull that's going to keep it up, something that is external, that, he says, is what human beings need. Man oscillates between the subjective I am and the objective I ought. And insofar as he strives for the ought, he transcends his self and actualizes his responsibleness. When you look for that, the I ought, meaning that which is outside of yourself, and here we get into finally, after 20 minutes, what meaning is about. As I understand the presentation of Frankl's own writing, and frankly also Rabbi Bolka's commentary on it, meaning is the way somebody reacts to, or the feeling one gets, the experience of participating in something which is valuable, and here I'll use his term, objectively valuable. What I mean by objectively valuable, I don't mean to say valuable to all people in the same way. It's objectively valuable means it's something which, if you polled 100 people, 100 people would all say this is meaningful to them. It's not what I mean. Rather, what I think Frankl means when he talks about something being objectively valuable is that it's not valuable for what it does for me. It's not valuable to me like there's a hamburger and I want to eat a hamburger, so a hamburger is valuable to me. It is something that is, and this is a word that Frankl uses a lot, transcendent. It's something that is more than just being about me. That's what he means when he says objectively valuable, is that it's not about my need and my experience. And that's where meaning is found in pursuing that sort of a goal. It is subjective in the sense that it depends on my nature, in the sense that different things will appeal to different people. In that sense, it's subjective, and it's up to my free will. However, it's objective in the sense that it is something that is beyond my personality, my needs, and serving my position in life. Is this somewhat clear?
Yeah. Apply that to the Dr. Watson case where he came out of his shell at the threshold event by contacting old colleagues and having chats. So I understand that's a therapeutic benefit, it'd be a good thing for him. How does that relate to this objective?
Right. It's a good question. I think that the idea there is that the camaraderie of others, right, being able to experience a dialogue with others, isn't only this sort of self-serving, we can reminisce about old times and I have someone to talk to. But I think it's that would be viewed as something that is an objective value in the sense that these are people you've built and created with. These are colleagues from his work, whatever his field is. I don't remember it saying in the paper. But I think that there is, I don't mean to say a work dimension in the sense that they're actually sitting down and going back to what they did. But I think there is something that isn't about meeting my own personal need in the conversations that he's having, that Watson is having with those colleagues. That's the way I would see it. I think as we talk more about meaning, this may become more clear. But I think that may be the idea. If it's just a matter of I am less bored because now when I speak, someone is there to respond to me, then I think it becomes much more personal. I think it's not limited to that.
Can I suggest something?
Yeah.
Susie was a retired philosophy professor.
Oh, less philosophy.
He was looking into kind of the meaning of life and stuff, and maybe he was just by talking about coming outside himself, not focusing on himself and his arthritis and his physical ailments. I mean, it was benefiting him too, but taking the focus away from self,
right,
onto outside self, yeah, may be
right,
where it relates a little bit.
Right.
The difference in it is that he's saying we're not robots. I mean, robots are programmed; they do exactly what they're set there to do. And it's all about them, because if it's not programmed in them, then they can't respond any other way.
Right.
But he's saying, Frankl's saying, that we can respond and we can do what we want with whatever the situation occurs, because we aren't robots, we're not strictly programmed.
Right. And here, actually, I want to develop that a little bit, because there's another point that he makes that I think is very significant. Meaning is not all about action, to Frankl. As far as Frankl is concerned, meaning is found sometimes in acting, right, creating, but it's also found in experiencing, and even in one's attitude. In all of those, meaning can be found, and he goes at great lengths, and this is something that we're not going to get to for the most part in this in this class, but he talks about this in terms of how one deals with love. He talks about it in terms of how one deals with death, how even in circumstances where there is no action to be taken, nonetheless, there can still be meaning. That doesn't rule out meaning. And that's something, and we're going to see it, we just won't see all the applications to it. Yeah?
I'm having trouble because you're saying meaning and I'm hearing value.
Maybe when we go a little bit further, the difference between those will be clarified. When you say value, you mean value as worth?
Value in some sphere.
Value in some sphere. Then I don't think that they're that far apart. I'm not the Malbim in terms of being able to say that there are no synonyms and every word has a unique connotation. But I think value is a part of meaning, or I'd say value to the person who is practicing it is a part, or experiencing it, having the attitude is a part of meaning and a critical part of it. I'm not sure it expresses the entirety of meaning, but I think it is essential to it. Okay. Let's take a look, please, at source number 9, because this is where Frankl says this. And again, this is actually a book commenting on Dr. Frankl. Frankl offers no proof that objective values exist. And again, that word objective, that which is outside of meeting my own needs. That these values are objective follows necessarily from Frankl's view of man. The human model, the properly functioning man, is directed towards meaning. If meaning were subjective, the dynamics of transcendence would be destroyed and existence would falter. Meaning, if it's all about serving my own ends, filling my stomach, so to speak, there's nothing transcendent, there's nothing outside of myself. And he says that wouldn't satisfy. Meaning must be objective. Frankl does categorize three species of values contained in life, and this is what I had already said, right? Creative values, experiential values, and attitudinal values. By the way, all the bold that you see here is me. They are not in the original. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Let's say I value white supremacy. To me, it was something that would be objective to me. I was looking at something that was objective. Although to real me, I would think it's not one of my ideologies. It's not something that I look at as something that's a good thing.
Right.
But for the person who thinks it, if it's someone who is an ideal, it's an objective meaning.
Correct. So that's actually what I had said before to Dr. Roth, that there are certain questions that come up in the course of this that I can't fully resolve. That's another one that comes up, and that's actually one of those that I had to follow up on after the Shari Shemayim session, because it came up there, and we're going to address it somewhat here, but not fully. We'll be left to a certain extent with the problem of what keeps meaning as something positive. Why can't meaning be something which I personally and society in general think is terrible, but to this person it provides fulfillment? So we are going to talk about it. We're just not quite there yet. There's nothing in what we've said.
Then it's not only objective to the person, but it's objective. I use the same verb too.
Yeah, I'm confused by objectively. I understand what the words mean, but I'm trying to wrap my mind around it.
You want to say there's one sort of goal which is good and one sort of goal which isn't considered objective goals?
Not necessarily. That's let me get to that point in it, because that's not quite where I would go with it. I think that there's something else to be said with it. If you wanted to jump ahead to Man's Search for Ultimate Meaning, you'd see more about it on in source 14. But I'm not there yet.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So what Frankl believes is that which provides meaning is still going to be influenced by the person's unique identity. And that's what makes it your way to find meaning. And I brought you a quote here in source number 10 to this effect from The Doctor and the Soul. The job at which one works is not what counts, but rather the manner in which one does the work. It does not lie with the occupation, but always with us, whether those elements of the personal and the specific which constitute the uniqueness of our existence are expressed in the work and thus make life meaningful. Do I emerge in this? There has to be something personal about this. Okay. We need to be engaged in this search, looking for this meaning. And as Frankl puts it, it's about the intensity we bring to the search, not even about finding whatever it is or achieving the goal in the end. And if you achieve the goal, bad news, you need a new goal. It isn't as though having achieved the goal means that's it, you're set for life and you now have achieved meaning. Take a look at source number 11 where he writes it in The Doctor and the Soul. We must never be content with what has already been achieved. Life never ceases to put new questions to us, never permits us to come to rest. For those who are familiar with Rashi in the beginning of Parshat Vayeshev, Bikesh Yaakov Leshev B'Shalva, right? Yaakov wanted to be able to rest. I think by any objective standard he had earned the right. And then, of course, Yosef is sold and he begins a new crisis. Hashem says that's not the way it works. There's always more. So the goal for us is to remain engaged in that search. And if somebody is frustrated in getting to search, that's what leads to neurosis. Neurosis is caused by a dissatisfied feeling of meaningless. It creates depression, it reduces the will to live and to act. So if you take a look at source number 12, he says, the spiritual crisis of retirement constitutes, so to speak, a permanent unemployment neurosis. But there is also a temporary periodical one, the Sunday neurosis, a depression which afflicts people who become conscious of the lack of content in their lives, the existential vacuum, when the rush of the busy week stops on Sunday and the void within them suddenly becomes manifest. When a person says, where am I now? What am I doing? And the answer isn't, this is what you're doing. That can lead to this neurosis within the person. Now, others have argued differently. They've argued that neurosis comes from other things. So Freud says it's frustration of the will to pleasure. Adler says it's frustration of the will to power. But Frankl says no. Pleasure, he says, is a result of finding meaning. It can't be the goal in and of itself because it won't itself provide meaning. He says power is just the means that you use in order to achieve meaning. But its value is only in the course of the pursuit. So how does a person identify that which is meaningful for him, that which is meaningful for her? I apologize that I keep using male pronouns. It's biological. I need to overcome my biology and search for meaning by getting off of the male pronoun. How does a person identify where they will find meaning? So we've already said that each situation and each individual is different. The meaningful action is relative to the situation. Right? If you take a look at source number 13, the chess analogy is used. There is, according to Frankl, no general, all-encompassing meaning of life. It is comparable to the question posed to a chess player. What is the best move? There is no best move, just as there is no universal meaning. Instead, meaning is detected in man's confrontation with his unique situation. Every man is unique. All situations are unique. Hence, all confrontations are unique. Each confrontation carries its own particular meaning. Man detects the objective meaning in the subjectiveness of his situation. Which takes me back now to the white supremacist question. So does that mean that you could find meaning in criminal activity, right? So this came up, and we discussed it when I did the session at Shai Shemayim, and afterwards I discussed it at length with Rabbi Bolka. And he noted that in later writing, Frankl contends that human beings have an unconscious religiosity, and that shapes their sense of what brings meaning. And if you're going to ask me, isn't that controversial within psychology? My answer will be, you bet. But this is Frankl's thought process. If you take a look at source number 14, this is from Man's Search for Ultimate Meaning. The starting point was the basic phenomenological fact that being human is being conscious and being responsible. He's tracing the development of the idea of the search for meaning. So this is the starting point, is we are conscious and we are responsible. The second stage of development was reached when experiential analysis ventured into unconscious spirituality. The unconscious logos was disclosed, logos meaning the word meaning, right? The unconscious logos was disclosed with the discovery of a spiritual unconscious in addition to the instinctual unconscious. Maybe I should translate logos better as purpose than meaning. But he says there's a sense that there is a spiritual unconscious. It's not just about your instincts that function unconsciously, but also in terms of somebody's spirit, there's something unconscious. Now in its third stage of development, existential analysis has uncovered within the spiritual unconscious, unconscious religiousness, a latent relation to transcendence inherent in man. If one prefers, one might conceive of this relation in terms of a relationship between the immanent self and a transcendent thou, which takes him, of course, into a discussion of God, which we have to come back to. Ari.
You find that between his first and second book, something happened that shifted him into a more spiritual ultimate meaning is much more spiritual than...
Right. This is actually quite a few years later. This is decades after the first book, as I recall. And he does evolve. And and I think there is a tendency, certainly in the material of his that I've seen, that comes later, as opposed to what he was writing in the 40s and 50s. I see a much more explicit reference to religious ideas. The only caveat that I have is that we're going to see shortly that he made a conscious attempt to take God out of logotherapy for reasons we'll discuss. And I don't know if his decision later to write more about this was because he only came to this later or because he became less reserved about the religious element to it. I don't know. It's an interesting idea. Yeah.
So I believe that Allah is telling me to kill Jews, and that is my God is telling me to kill Jews. But
yeah.
That also
potentially.
Yeah.
Yes. The answer is yes. Meaning, at least the way I read his writing, is that it's not so much about a particular religion. He's not promoting the idea that this is the Jewish God or any other particular God. It's a religiousness rather than a tie to a particular religion. I think that's true. Scary, but true. As a practical point, what this means is that meaning is not found by telling somebody, you know, there's meaning in what you do. And on the one hand, it's obvious, and on the other hand, it has to be said. Because I can't tell you how many times, I've been in conversations with somebody who is in the position of lacking meaning, and I just want to say to them, well, look what you're doing. And isn't that meaning? No, you can't do that. It doesn't work. You can't tell them there is meaning. And he writes it in source number 15. He says, it goes without saying that meaning and purpose in life are no matter of prescription. It is not the job of a doctor to give meaning to the patient's life. But it may well be his task through an existential analysis to enable the patient to find meaning in life. And in my opinion, meaning is something to be found rather than to be given. They have to come to this. It isn't something that you can tell them. The patient has to try endeavors in which they may or may not find meaning. They may have to go through a series of possibilities until they find something that resonates. And the other piece of it is, that it doesn't have to be that everything in a person's life centers around meaning. It could be that their career doesn't give them meaning, but they can find meaning in what they do in their leisure time. And if they use their leisure time to sleep, well, maybe that has meaning, because it provides them the ability to function in other aspects of their life. For some people, it's going to be their family. For some people, it's going to be their communal activities. There are all sorts of different aspects of a person's life, and not all of them have to be meaningful in order to save the person from this neurosis that that Frankl describes. I hope we have a better sense now than we did 40 minutes ago about what logotherapy is and what Frankl's conception of meaning is. I have to say, I've been like thinking about this, you know, for months and months and months, and I still can't say that I know what this is. But I hope that this gives some sense of it, and we can now turn to approach our two basic questions. Number one, is logotherapy rooted in Jewish ideas? And number two, is this going to be useful for an observant Jew? So Viktor Frankl, the man, as we've said, was Jewish. It's very clear in his identity. It's very clear in his language. He was a psychotherapist in Austria before the war. I don't know what his level of religious involvement was. He went through the camps, as described in Man's Search for Meaning. While there, as we've said, he observed... Actually, we didn't quite say this. While there, he observed that those who have a meaning, those who have a task for which they must live, a sense of value in their existence, were more likely to survive. Not they were more likely to respond better. They were more likely to be generous people. That's not what he said. But he says they were more likely to survive if they had a sense of a task that to live for, a value in why they were living. And in his writing and in his speaking, Frankl is cognizant of his Judaism, and he is, in my lexicon, decidedly spiritual / religious. When he speaks personally, he expresses religious beliefs. Take a look at source number 16, please, from Man's Search for Meaning. Instead of the many pages of my manuscript, this is about an experience where he found something in his pocket in the camps. He had a manuscript that was taken. Instead of the many pages of my manuscript, I found in a pocket of the newly acquired coat a single page torn out of a Hebrew prayer book, which contained the main Jewish prayer, Shema Yisrael. How should I have interpreted such a, quote, coincidence, other than as a challenge to live my thoughts, instead of merely putting them on paper? Right, my manuscript is gone, and in place of it I have Shema Yisrael, and he finds meaning, literally, he finds meaning in that experience as a message to him about what he ought to be doing. More powerfully, take a look at 17. One day, a few days after the liberation, I walked through the country past flowering meadows for miles and miles toward the market town near the camp. Larks rose to the sky, and I could hear their joyous song. There was no one to be seen for miles around. There was nothing but the wide earth and sky and the lark's jubilation and the freedom of space. I stopped, looked around and up to the sky, and then I went down on my knees. At that moment, there was very little I knew of myself or of the world. I had but one sentence in mind, always the same. I called to the Lord from my narrow prison, and he answered me in the freedom of space. How long, that's Tehillim. How long I knelt there and repeated this sentence memory can no longer recall, but I know that on that day, in that hour, my new life started. Step for step I progressed until I again became a human being. So what comes to mind for him when he's been liberated is El Hashem Bitzaras Ali, right? That's what comes to him is a line from Tehillim. One more source, in source number 18. This is Frankl being quoted from a conversation. He says, as I see it, religion tries to give answers by offering man various answers in terms of myths and symbols, and it offers man a choice. By and large, he is born into such a language. Remember what I say about languages, a system of symbols. Here I begin to pray, to put on in the morning my tefillin, where I cannot find rational answers but have to commit myself. If someone could just close the door, because I think people are leaving the next minion. Thank you. He says, where I cannot find rational answers, but have to commit myself, have to make my selection. I believe in this God, in this incomprehensible deity. I am approaching him by way of prayer, by way of rituals, even putting on the tefillin, and in the evening reading the Psalms. This is my language when I address myself to God. And I abhor and would negate the right of anyone to say, Victor, why do you speak to deity in this language? Why have you made it your habit since the first day in concentration camp to read in the Psalms each day? Why don't you accept the sacraments? Why do you make confession to George Vlahos, who's a priest he's having this conversation with, as a priest? Sounds awfully religious to me. Whether that means that he's going to be a practicing Jew every day or keep kosher or anything else, that's not my point. But it's clear that he has a strong religious sensibility to him and identity to him. One writer talked about visiting his apartment and seeing the well-worn mezuzah outside of the apartment. I'm assuming it wasn't kissed by all the visitors. I'm assuming that, you know, that's Frankel. And he uses religious texts, not only Jewish ones, to explain ideas in logotherapy. He has many non-Jewish sources. A lot of his philosophy actually traced to Max Scheler, who had a Jewish mother and a Lutheran father. But he invokes Jewish texts to explain his ideas. Take a look at source number 19, right, where he quotes Hillel. If I don't do it, who will do it? And if I don't do it right now, when should I do it? But if I do it for my sake only, right, that objective point, what am I? If I don't do it, dot, dot, dot. This seems to me, he says, to refer to the uniqueness of my own self. If I don't do it right now refers to the uniqueness of the passing moment which gives me an opportunity to fulfill a meaning. And if I do it for my own sake only, what here comes in is no more or less than the self-transcendent quality of human existence. The question, what am I if I do it for my own sake only, requires the answer. In no event...
Not a translation.
Correct. Correct. Let me just finish his quote. He says, what am I if I do it for my own sake only, requires the answer. In no event a truly human being. For it is a characteristic constituent of human existence that it transcends itself, that it reaches out for something other than itself. Don't leave the quote just yet, because as the young man just pointed out, it isn't a precise quote of Hillel. Where is it not? The beginning. If I don't do it, who will do it? What is that? Is that quite the same?
No.
No, it's not. It's a different thought altogether. It's not a precise quote of Hillel. It's the way he remembers what Hillel has said. And I'm going to come back to that. He brings in the importance of Shabbos, interestingly. Take a look at source number 20. The meaning of Shabbat may well consist in reaching beyond work. There are creative values, there are experiential values, there are attitudinal values. This means we may find the meaning in our own lives through a deed we are doing, through a work we are creating, through an achievement and accomplishment, through creativity, 6 days. But also through our experience. Not through what we give to the world, but what we receive from the world, what we take in. Like, Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch would be very comfortable with this paragraph. This is a paragraph you could find in many writers of the last few centuries in trying to describe the message of Shabbos.
I don't understand that.
Yeah.
Does that relate to the meaning of Shabbat?
Because his point is that there's meaning not only in work, but also in experiencing something. You're not creating anymore. This is not what I'm doing. Right? I'm now just experiencing. I mean, Hirsch takes it in a different direction. Hirsch talks about it in terms of the arrogance of the creator and learning that you're not in control of everything. But the idea that it isn't just about creating, it's also about experiencing, and there is meaning as well, is what Frankel is trying to do. However, as I said before, Frankel denies a fundamental religious character for logotherapy for a few reasons, which are frankly, to me, a little bit unsatisfying. His reasons are basically pragmatic. he says, if you take a look at source number 21, he's addressing Rabbi Bulka directly. Rabbi Bulka's belief is that this is a very religious thing, and it's stopping short by not making itself explicitly religious and explicitly not Jewish per se, but religious. So Frankel responds in 21, "You are pushing forward things. You are, as you say yourself, completing the logotherapeutic system by taking in the Talmudic wisdom. True, this is a frailty, a shortcoming of logotherapy. It stops short, you are used to repeating. But on the other hand, in another dimension, in the horizontal, this is an asset of logotherapy because I can reach the atheistic patient, the agnostic patient as well, possibly finally opening up a door to the other dimension, while you who are adding, complementing the logotherapeutic view, get a hearing a priori by and large only from the devout Orthodox Jewish religious man. So what is at first a frailty might be an asset in practical use." He says, if I make it too Jewish, then I close off everybody else. I want to be able to help them find their way to meaning, and so I don't take the steps that you think are necessary to evolve this approach. He also writes separately that he's afraid of alienating other psychologists. He also is concerned about the Hippocratic Oath. He's concerned that there's an element of imposing the religion of the therapist on the patient. It reminds me very much, for anyone who reads Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky, in his writing on spirituality, which is extensive, also, he refrains by and large from invoking elements that are particularly Jewish in order to give it an appeal to a broader audience, in order to make sure that it'll work for a broader group. It's the same type of a thing. So what he says is that it doesn't need to be Jewish, even if Judaism would add a dimension to it. If you take a look at source number 22, Rabbi Avram Ansel said something, I think, that sums this up. He says, "Whereas Dr. Frankel seems to feel that man can find this meaning in many varied avenues of life, Judaism's view is that a truly meaningful life, one that produces the contentment and peace of mind which is real and unadulterated, can be achieved only through the, I'm going to get this word right, apotheosizing, I think, of faith and trust in God, through rendering all other joys and satisfactions subservient to the one true joy of serving the Almighty. That's what's missing, is the idea that Torah is the place to find meaning." Rabbi Bulka said it somewhat differently, and it echoes our comments about Islam, or not really Islam per se, but the idea of jihad, any other approach which we have difficulty with. He says, if it's not religious, who creates the values? Right? Where does it come from if it's not religious?
Well, I think that in verse 22, I don't know, the summary, but
yeah,
he's not talking about faith in Torah. He's broadening it to faith and trust in God, so that any person, a Noahite, can find trust in God. And
Right. That's true. But the text he would be using is a text that preaches a particular religion and a particular story of the universe and of what God wants. Right?
Yeah.
But yes, I don't mean to say that he would be saying that it's only for Jews, therefore. It would still have a universal component. So,
why does meaning depend on formal religion?
Why
it does for us. Why for anybody else does it depend on being within a formal, structured religion?
So, in Frankel's view, it isn't so much that it depends on a formal religion, as that human beings have this unconscious religiousness, which means that these religious ideas are going to be where they will find meaning. It's a practical point almost. You will find meaning in elements that are somewhat religious in nature, not religious in the sense of picking up a lulav. Religious in terms of the ideas, the philosophy, the idea of something that is beyond yourself, towards which you reach, and that has ideals that you view as valuable.
But that crosses into the realm of spirituality and it's why he talks about atheists, and it's why, in my opinion, he doesn't cross over and add the specific Jewish realm.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're saying it's unsatisfactory, fine. It's unsatisfactory to believing toward you. Okay. But it still helps everybody else.
No, I'm saying he thinks that it won't be satisfying to a human being to believe in to believe in something which is unreligious. I don't mean Jewish, un-Jewish, but which is unreligious. I think that's what he's saying. Sorry? I think not science per se, but I think one would within logotherapy, one could find meaning in the scientific pursuit, which is aimed at developing an understanding of the universe, or which is developed, which is geared towards helping people by creating advances. That these are things that transcend oneself, and because of that, may help someone pursue meaning.
Comes the religion of science.
Effectively, yes. Now, I want to make sure to get to this next part, because this is the last section, and it's an important one, I think. We've answered question one of or we've somewhat answered question one. Is this rooted in Judaism? You're talking about Frankl as somebody who has an inherent religiosity, but who doesn't want to tie this into religion, not just doesn't want to tie it into Judaism, but doesn't want to tie it clearly into religion for fear of alienating others. If only for that reason, he doesn't want to scare people off, both other professionals as well as patients who could be helped. Ari, and then I'm going to go further.
Where was he holding as far as his observance?
I don't know. I know about the mezuzah. I know he describes himself saying Tehillim. I'm not sure when he talks about himself and the first person putting on tefillin every day, whether he's actually describing what he does or giving that as a hypothetical. It is unclear to me in the source, going back to what he had said in number 18. I wasn't sure.
So I heard his story with the Lubavitch Rebbe.
There is quite a bit about his relationship with the Lubavitch Rebbe online. I've seen that. Yes, there's a video out. Yes. So is logotherapy something that would be consistent with Judaism and useful for believing Jews? I think the answer is yes. I think there are a lot of similarities between what he's talking about and what you find in particular in the schools of Hasidus and Musar. I think there's a lot there. First, let's start from his view of human nature. Right? The uniqueness of man is certainly mentioned within Judaism. I brought you one source of many. You could, in source number 23, the Gemara towards the end of Brachos, which talks about Haroa Uchlusa Yisrael, one who sees Jewish crowds. So that person should say, Baruch Chacham Harazim. Blessed is the wise one of secrets, talking about God, obviously. Shein datam domez zeh lazeh. Vein partsufein domim zeh lazeh. Their intellects do not resemble each other. Their forms do not resemble each other. Each of us is unique. There's much more that you could say about this, right? One of the classics is the Or HaMeir, which is a Hasidic sefer, on the Haggadah, saying the reason why you have Keneged Arba Banim in the Haggadah, right? You have this the four kids in the Haggadah, which traces to the Torah, and the Torah is saying four different times, you shall tell your child, he says, is because each person experiences Yitzias Mitzrayim, getting out of Egypt, differently. Each of us has a unique situation. Certainly the idea of free will is very strong in Judaism. I feel silly even bringing a source to support it, because you really should bring 100. But I brought you just one. The Gemara in Nida talks about a malach bringing the fertilized egg before God when a child is conceived, and saying, what's going to be with this child, right? Ribono shel olam, tipazu, matei aleh. What's going to be with this drop? Gibor or chalash, powerful or weak, chachamo tipesh, wise or foolish, ashir or ani, wealthy or poor, but rasha o tzadik lo ka'amar. He doesn't say wicked or righteous. That's up to you. And again, there are many, many sources you could bring to support the idea, as well as to support Frankl's formulation that there are environmental factors and it's up to us to respond. The Gemara at the end of Shabbos speaks about the astrological signs. You know, there's a classic debate in Jewish sources to the extent as to the extent of the power of astrology. Do you really think that the constellations and such have any power over us? The speaker in the Gemara there at the end of Shabbos does believe it. However, he says, "Ein mazel Yisrael," which doesn't mean Jews have no mazel. What it means is that that the constellations do not control us. It is up to us to decide how we will respond to that influence. It's up to us to determine what to do with it. There's much more to be said on that as well, in terms of free will. What about the importance of meaning? The importance of finding purpose, finding meaning. So the idea that there are transcendent, valuable acts, things we pursue that are not about feeding ourselves and satisfying our preferences, is something prevalent within Judaism. Most plainly, these are what we call mitzvos. Right? That's the idea of it. There is something I am supposed to pursue, which is not about how I feel, and it's not about what I want, and it's not about meeting my own needs. A person can do it shalo lishma. Person can do it, not, you know, for their own sake. But the ideal is lishma, for a person to do it because, you know, there's an ideal out there that I'm meant to fulfill. Sorry, there's an idea out there that I am meant to fulfill. Rav Chaim of Volozhin is famous for saying, source number 25. I like this quote so much. I just try to insert it in every shiur I can. This is Rav Chaim Volozhin is the founder of the great Volozhin yeshiva, the paramount yeshiva in Europe over the last centuries. And his comment, as quoted by his son, is you see it here, Ha'adam lo la'atzmo nivra. He says, actually, I should start before that. He says, Shezeh kol ha'adam. This is the entirety of the person. Lo la'atzmo nivra, a person is not created for himself. Rak laho alachrini, only to benefit others. Kechol asher yimtza bekochol la'asos, to with whatever power he has in his possession. The goal is not about me. It's not about myself. Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, in source number 26, frames the person's purpose in terms of realizing what it is that God wanted, making real in this universe that which Hashem wanted. Hamishpat, there you see it. Divine justice, it's in 26, shapes human existence and gives it the form the Creator intended at the time of creation. For a person is created only in order to freely make real the divine desire. That's my translation of the Hebrew, which comes from the German, but I think it's still, I expect, true to his intent. The idea that there is meaning beyond ourselves to pursue and that this is what we're here for is something central to Judaism. I brought you a quote from the Rav, Rabbi Soloveitchik, in the meaning, the emergence of ethical man. He talks about how when you go back to Bereishis, the beginning of the Torah, human beings, plants, animals, birds, fish, are all created with roughly similar language. We all emerge from the ground. Right, we're blessed with bear fruit and multiply. We're told that we can only eat the plants, just like the animals are told they can only eat the plants. There's a lot that's common between us, and what marks the difference in human experience is when Hashem turns to Adam first, and then later Adam and Chava, and says, "I am giving you a command." It is commandedness that makes the human being different. As the Rav of Soloveitchik said it in 27, God takes man animal into his confidence, addresses him, and reveals to him his moral will. That's what makes us human. And I always find it interesting to note, which tree did we eat from in the garden?
Eitz Hadas.
Which tree did we not eat from in the garden? Eitz Chaim. If you had a choice between the two, which one would you choose? Right, why did they choose the Eitz Hadas? What is that? What message does that convey? We were looking for meaning, not for power and pleasure. Now, it was wrong. We were told not to do that. So that's a separate shear. But we went looking for meaning. Happiness for the person is not found in power or pleasure, says Frankl. And pursuit of these won't work, he says. Well, for that, you can just open up Koheles, right? That's the book of Ecclesiastes. That's the whole story. Searching for power, searching for pleasure is not going to give you meaning in life. And the classic line in the Medrash in Koheles Rabba, source number 28, the Hebrew is on one side, the English is at the top of the other side. Ein adam yotzei min ha'olam v'chatzita baso biyado. A person does not leave this world with even half of his desires fulfilled. That's not the way that you find satisfaction in this world. You don't achieve the pleasures. Finally, the idea that a person will feel neurosis when they feel they're not pursuing meaning is also found throughout Jewish literature. I brought you a Mishnah in Ksuvos. This is the classic. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, a man marries a woman, and he wants to show that he's going to support her. And he takes a neder, he takes a vow, that his wife should never work. He's going to provide maids, he's going to provide a living, whatever it is. He says, she may not work. He's obligated to divorce her and pay her the ksuba. Why? Because habatala mevia lidei shiyamum. Idleness leads to shiyamum. Shiyamum does not have a great translation in English. The closest I know of is depression. It's depression / desolation, boredom. But the idea is that a person needs a purpose. He thinks he's doing her a favor. I mean, it would be better for do ataras nadarim than have to go through a divorce for this. There are other ways he can deal with this. But the strong statement is meant to be a strong statement. That's the idea. People need to be able to find something to do. I brought you a similar source in Avos Rabbi Nassan in source 30. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Ahoves hamalacha, right? A person should love work. Says Avos Rabbi Nassan, Chayav adam lios ohoves hamalacha ba'osik b'malacha. One is obligated to love work and involve himself in work. And remember, malacha in Hebrew is usually a term for a creative task, not just like something, you know. It's not just a matter of busy work as much as there's a creativity to it. The same passage, source number 30, suggests that when the Torah says, Sheshes yamim ta'avod v'asisa kamalachtecha, 6 days you shall work and do all of your melacha, and then the seventh day is Shabbos, there's a mitzvah, so to speak, in the first half of the sentence. The mitzvah is not only on day seven you should rest, but that on 6 days you should work. And it goes on to bring you a reference from one of the Tanaim, one of the sages, who, it isn't in the part of it that I quoted here, who actually on Friday would specifically go out and find work to do in his yard, even if it meant just moving things from one corner of the yard to another corner of the yard, just because he wanted to show the demarcation of this is what we do all week long, we are supposed to be engaged in this, and then on Shabbos we do not. Rav Kook speaks about this as well in source number 31 in Orot HaTshuva. He says, all sins cause the heart to grieve. In the interest of time, I'm just doing the English. For they demolish the unity of the individual person and the universe. Every ethical severing from that whole, whether through thoughts or deeds, individual traits or general balance, causes many small cuts which instigate great internal pain for all aspects of the soul. He describes an internal neurosis that comes from knowing that I am not acting properly. And he has much more to say about this. And his belief is that there is something inside the person, of course, Rav Kook is going to talk about it in the context of the neshama, in the context of the soul, that knows when I am not fulfilling my potential and is upset by it, that grieves as a result of it. So the basic ideas that we've seen in logotherapy, the idea of the uniqueness of the human being, the idea of free will, the importance of meaning and meaningful activity, that happiness is not found in power and pleasure, but in the pursuit of this sense of mission, the neurosis that comes when we're not acting in consonance with this, all of this is seen in Jewish thought, and I think therefore will resonate to someone who's familiar with these sources. If you talk to somebody who is living this life, the ideas of logotherapy make a lot of sense. Finally, still within this association between Judaism and logotherapy, the way in which we pursue meaning, is very similar. The only core difference that I would identify in terms of how we pursue meaning is that within logotherapy, you're looking to yourself and to see what resonates. Whereas within Judaism, classically, I'm supposed to look to Revelation. What is it that God told me resonates? And that is a major difference. If you read the beginning of the Kuzari, you know, the king, right, the king of the Khazars, has a dream in which he's told, your intentions are good, but what you're doing is not what God wants you to do. It assumes that there is a set of what God wants you to do, and you, working on your own, won't come up with it. You need to look to Revelation. And that's a stark difference between the two. But take a look, in terms of the idea that your specialization depends on you as an individual. Source number 32, please, then it's Siv. He writes about this in Parshas Balak, on the pasuk that I reference here, which describes the Jews as being like a river running past a garden. So he talks about gardening. And he says, each garden has one central variety, and small quantities of other varieties are planted around it. So too, each Jew is filled with the mitzvos of God. But each has one special mitzvah in which he is extra careful. He writes about it more on the pasuk v'lo sasurach elevavchem ve'achrei einechem at the end of Parshas Shlach. He writes about it beautifully, about the fact that different aspects of Judaism are going to resonate differently with each of us. And that doesn't mean that we drop the things that don't resonate. From a Jewish perspective, that's unacceptable. But what it does mean is that different aspects will really resonate with different people. And you can't force people into a particular box and say, learn all day, or engage in chesed all day, or daven all day, or so on and so forth. For some people, shatnez is what's going to do it. Like, that's really the truth of it. Different mitzvos really will resonate differently with different people, and your specialization is a function of who you are. Rav Kook has a beautiful poem. I translated here just the most basic part of it, but I want to do, if I remember, I'm going to email out to the email list. And again, if you didn't sign in with your email address, please do so. But I'm going to email out the full poem, which I've translated, because it's so beautiful. It's called Al Hiki Shofar. And what he talks about in the poem is the importance of the individual, and how the world needs each individual to pursue that which resonates with them. You can't force people into a box, and it's counterproductive to try to do so. And presumably, this is all part of why Frankl acknowledges that a religious person will do better with logotherapy. Because this is so clear within Judaism, but frankly not only within Judaism. I think in many religions, these ideas are found. I don't think it's exclusively to us. But he sees this as the basic way in which one will find meaning and diffuse the neurosis that creates such a crisis for people. That's basically where I wanted to go with this. There's a lot more to be said, but I think we're basically at time anyway. I'm going to stick around for questions. Again, the next session that I'm doing is Monday evening, the 27th, at Shari Shemayim on sharing a terminal diagnosis with a